Since the theme of our meeting is exceptionalism and American exceptionalism, we can cast this a little bit more broadly and think about what does it mean to be exceptional? What does that word exceptional, what connotation does that carry? To stand apart, to be different, to be noticed. Well, a desire to be noticed, a desire for notice, to stand out from others, is a characteristic human trait. And you can see it in things from Homer's Iliad, right through the popular culture of the present day. But what confers the distinction that makes somebody stand out? Is it just different for the sake of being different? Or is it different for having some kind of merit, something that makes you outstanding, standing out? From the founding of the early republic, Americans decisively rejected the legitimacy of hereditary distinctions and insisted upon a fundamental equality before the law. Thomas Jefferson drew upon a very long tradition when he spoke in 1826 of, and I quote, "the palpable truth that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God." Yet, Jefferson agreed with John Adams 13 years earlier that, and again I quote, "there is a natural aristocracy among men, grounded in virtue and talents." So what provides the distinction? It's not going to be a hereditary, inherited title or rank, and it's not just being different. What is it going to be? Well, the concept of natural aristocracy within a republican polity, it provides a distinctive idea of the gentleman, defined by conduct and accomplishment, not by status. And that deeply influenced American culture right into the 20th century. And I'd argue that recovering that idea of the gentleman as an expression of natural aristocracy offers an alternative to various kinds of base ambition that Alexis de Tocqueville detected even in the 1840s, and we can see so commonly today in the culture of celebrity in the mass media age. Now, Jefferson took that famous phrase about the mass of mankind not having been born with saddles on their back, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them, from Colonel Richard Rumbold, who was a Cromwellian soldier executed in 1685 for his part in the Rye House plot. Rumbold spoke those words in a defiant speech from the gallows, and later authors quoted them in a variety of political and historical works that Jefferson and his contemporaries among the founders would have known. And more importantly, that phrase expressed a republican critique of hereditary privilege that resonated during the founding and early republican era. James Fenimore Cooper, the novelist, who was no egalitarian himself, Cooper wrote that aristocracies wound the sense of natural justice by placing men altogether unworthy of trust in high hereditary situations. And this not only offended morals, but it sometimes damaged the public interest. Now, Cooper, like Jefferson and even Rumbold, expressed himself satisfied that God hath wisely ordained different stations for men in the world and accepted differences among men according to their talents and merits, gaining the respect and therefore the deference of others through the exercise of talent and character. That marked the true criterion of natural rather than hereditary aristocracy, what you did, not who you were. Now, Cooper viewed social station as mainly a consequence of property. But property alone did not make a gentleman in America. Property secured independence and the potential for influence through wealth and a recognized stake in the community. But realizing that potential demanded much more, as men like George Washington realized. William Blackstone famously described the English as a polite and commercial people. Much the same could have been said of 18th century Americans. Lord Chesterfield described politeness as a superior gracefulness in all you say and do. Now, Samuel Johnson, the great Dictionary Johnson, dismissed Chesterfield's letters to his son as teaching the morals of a whore and the manners of a dancing master. Okay. Adam Smith also pointed out that that to superficial minds, the vices of the great seem at all times agreeable. Well, the answer to that conundrum was not to reject politeness, but rather to reject vice, to emphasize virtue. And the importance of virtue in aligning the forms of behavior with the essence of noble character. Particularly in America, virtue became a recurring 18th century theme, and that easily translated into a republican idiom from the 1770s. Now, of course, polite culture rested on a hierarchical foundation, emulating a patrician ethos. But the power of assimilation to that ethos made for a relatively open elite. Those who cultivated gentility had the ability to rise above circumstance and become a gentleman. Montesquieu recognized the natural desire of distinguishing ourselves. And so, since politeness could be learned, not only in manners, but also through acquaintance with arts and culture, it became a readily sought mark of what Americans called a natural aristocracy. Just as societies passed from rudeness to refinement, so individuals could cultivate the politeness expected of a gentleman and acquire refinement themselves. Now, George Washington demonstrated a gentlemanly integrity and a measured purposefulness that made him the archetype of natural aristocracy for Americans. From childhood, Washington devoted great effort into acquiring polite manners and also developing the broader attributes of a gentleman. Washington saw life, public life in particular, as a kind of performance. There was a role he and others like him were expected to play, learning that role, internalizing that script. It's part of being a gentleman. Although Washington stands out in particular, Gordon Wood and other recent historians looking at Enlightenment America have described how the founding generation assimilated the culture of politeness and adapted the idea of the gentleman to Republican America. Colonial ambitions, however narrow, encompassed the aspiration of being recognized as a gentleman, along with gaining material possessions and acquiring public office. And the American Revolution in the early decades of the United States raised the sights of Americans. David Ramsey pointed out that the Revolution called forth many virtues and gave occasion for the display of abilities, which, but for that event, would have been lost to the world. It seemed as if the war, the Revolution, not only required, but it created talents. Now, we could say much the same of framing the Constitution and bringing that Constitution into operation. So the desire for fame, the desire to stand out, the desire to earn the respect of others, that drove men who'd look to the past, who'd look to history, English history, but also to classical antiquity. It drove them to aspire to virtue, to express virtue. And in doing that, they set their own examples, which later generations followed. Now, the idea of the gentleman as an example of natural aristocracy proved remarkably resilient, and it also was very adaptable. Shaped by commercial society in the 18th century, it fit the aspirations of merchants, as well as wealthy farmers, of planters. Professional men, especially lawyers and clergy, already fell within its scope. The backlash from 1789 against the French Revolution and its leveling wind strengthened it. While moral reform mainly reinforced the cultivation of virtue at the expense of no longer fashionable vices, Jacksonian democracy presented a more serious challenge in America, but that was a challenge that led many critics of Jacksonian democracy to refine their own outlook. Though not born to ride others or be ridden by them, men had natural differences shaped by society that made some men worthy of distinction, more worthy of distinction than others. So the equality before the law did not void the claim of superior talent and education. Men of that era, defenders of the idea of the gentleman and natural aristocracy, would have looked back approvingly to Shaftesbury's view that all politeness is owing to liberty, while also pointing out that leadership of natural aristocracy provided a check on the democracy, a check on the mass that secured liberty. Tyranny, they understood, could be exercised by the many no less than by the one or by the few. Now, James Fenimore Cooper offered a thoughtful defense of natural aristocracy in his book, The American Democrat, published in 1838, and he wrote of the social and political duties of the American gentleman. Not only did such men set the manners, taste, and tone of society, encouraging civilization by their example, but they also bore the responsibility of guarding public liberties against demagogues and visionaries. Learning gave a gentleman a wider vision, grounded in history, while economic independence protected against the temptation of servility. Interestingly, Cooper also wrote that the gentleman has usually no pride in the mere vulgar consequences of wealth. It's not about getting and spending. It's not about dying with the most toys. Cooper's view takes as a given the idea that wealth and property serve as a means of securing independence rather than as an object in themselves. Politeness, not possessions, marked the determining characteristic of a gentleman. Now, although those words polite and politeness were used less and less than in the 18th century, the underlying approach in its broadest sense remains central to the understanding of the gentleman. Literature and the arts, even when disparaged as a little Greek and less Latin, or a little Latin rather and less Greek, of the cliché about the education of the gentry, that dominated elite education, not just among the southern planter class, but also among the commercial bourgeoisie of the eastern seaboard. It had a formative expression. Nicholas Biddle of Philadelphia exemplified that ideal of the educated and cultivated gentleman. By the way, Pierre Goodrich in the 20th century, who founded Liberty Fund, is another example of the businessman as educated man who understood the value of learning and of culture. George Ticknor, Edward Everett, Samuel Morse all worked to promote culture in Boston and New York. Ticknor, as founder of the Boston Public Library, he promoted the wide circulation of books to give poor citizens access to reading. He and Everett saw the humanistic tradition as a formative aspect of an education where learning joined with civility to form habits of mind. Those habits of mind defined the American gentleman. Now, much later in the 20th century, Andrew Lytle described the essence of liberal education as it became known. Lytle described it as graduating a Christian gentleman, a Christian gentleman who will go back home or out into the world and be what he is. Not a trained specialist, but one whose mind will be presumably a trained instrument, which can respond to any kind of experience. That capacity enables a gentleman to lead by example and also by exercising judgment, a judgment formed not just by his own immediate experiences, but by an education that inculcates critical thought, a sensibility and standards that make criticism an exercise in judgment rather than an exercise in repudiation. Now, that outlook dominated most American colleges, particularly as many of those colleges gave up an earlier function of training clergy, training ministers, and took up the new project of forming the character of an elite. That influence persisted right through what one might call the bourgeois period of American history, up to about 1955 or so, 1950s. The literary critic, Henry Sydell Canby, who taught for a time at Yale, he remarked in his memoirs that many of the traits that have made the 20th century American in business and in the professions sprang from the alumni of the old colleges, who brought, I quote, a stabilizing of character and temperament, and also of prejudice. Public culture benefited from that stabling influence through the tumultuous decades of the first half of the 20th century. It provided ballast. It provided a mediating and limiting character in the emergence of mass democracy. But after 1950, that ideal seemed increasingly threadbare. By the 1970s, the era when the 60s reached most of America, it was gone with the wind. Now, what does all of this really mean? It's talking about the gentleman. It's talking about this simply an exercise in nostalgia. Or is it just recovering a past mentality, delving into American social history, into the history of ideas, fishing back into 18th century thought about commercial society and what that meant for character? Well, I would say no. I'd say it's more than that. Recovering the idea of the gentleman as an American expression of natural aristocracy is much more than delving into something. It's recovering a model. It's recovering a history we've lost. Because behind Rumbold's words that Jefferson found so compelling lies an important question. If men are not born to either subjection or superiority, what brings somebody to accept the authority of another? What confers distinction? What enables someone to stand out? What justifies it all? The idea of the gentleman and the politeness defined in a broader sense, not just as superficial manners, but as culture and as manners as the expression of a morality. Indeed, all manners do rest on moral presuppositions of one form or other. The idea of the gentleman and politeness, that provided an answer to the question of to whom do we defer, that justified, that balanced democratic and aristocratic principles. Not only did it provide a measure for distinction, but it also set a standard to which men, and dare I say, women or ladies, might aspire. The standard itself limited the exercise of social authority, softened relations. It internalized restraints. That word measured purposefulness that I used to describe George Washington. In short, the idea of the gentleman provided a ballast that stabilized American democracy for a long time. Now, other measures of distinction exist, to be sure. We hear another word, meritocracy. And that word has staked a claim. It has come to dominate the world that David Brooks described as the world of the organization kid in an Atlantic Monthly essay. Now, meritocracy really seems to mean picking up credentials rather than necessarily accomplishing anything of real merit. The word brings to mind Andrew Lytle's famous remark that it's customary to betray in the name of what is being betrayed. Celebrity. What about celebrity? That's pretty democratic, isn't it? And didn't Andy Warhol say everybody gets their 15 minutes of fame? But then again, fame for what? You are distinguished by what? By being peculiar, being strange, being different? Where is the standard within that? What do we gain from that? And I would end by setting some of these new trends, new possibilities, meritocracy, celebrity, the age of People magazine, Oprah Winfrey and the Jerry Springer Show, the age of the technocrat, setting these ideas up against that older American tradition of the gentleman and saying, perhaps the world we've forgotten deserves another look. Thank you very much.